For the last time, turn open to John. Not the last time for you, but the last for today and tomorrow and the next day. I want to raise a preliminary question before discussing some of the content of chapter 21, and it's a question that grows out of and is intimately related to, I believe, some of the matters of biblical interpretation that we've considered all along. And I want to just bring the subject up, and if you want to take it for very long, that's fine. If not, that's fine too. We have looked at the resurrection stories. You've looked in particular at all of them. There's something that I want to stress about the way some modern scholars understand the notion of resurrection, and that places it into the framework, in a way, of our general discussion of miracles and the miraculous. Now, Rudolf Bultmann, a leading and recently dead in old age New Testament critic. Some of you have been using his commentary. His best known book probably is 2 volumes worth of New Testament theology. Bultmann was a radical New Testament critic who has been hated by some and loved by others. Hated for the most part because he was understood to be a rather radical and negative critic of the biblical material. He analyzed and he took apart and he questioned whether miracles really took place. And in general, he tried to interpret the New Testament in a way that it would be, in a way, palatable to modern people. What he really wanted to do was make sure that you stumble, if you're going to stumble at the message of Christianity, that you stumble at the right thing and not at the wrong thing. Therefore, he was wont to say very frequently, this or that miracle smacks of legendary accretion. And that really didn't, that's just a legend, or it didn't really happen this way, or he in general questioned the historicity of the narratives. And whereas to, at least down to the beginning of the 20th century, for the most part at least, the way of understanding the Bible was a very strict literalism. The Bible said so, it happened, and you didn't question that. Of course, with the 20th century, in fact, with the late 19th century, there was certainly the strong advent of historical questioning about historical reports and accounts in the biblical material. And of course, what the conservatives, so to speak, feared all along when someone questioned the veracity of this or that miracle account, say. What people feared all along, as we've alluded to before in discussing the domino theory, was that finally, if you opened up the Bible to any questioning, you were going to open up ultimately it to the question of the resurrection. That's what people really fear. And as one person once said in a discussion of matters such as this, by analogy to all other historical events, you place it in a realm, in a sphere of things which are open to proof or disproof. And he said, if you do that, then it is, you are opening the resurrection up to the possibility of disproof. And he said, the resurrection is a phenomenon which transcends all other historical events and which is of a different order. Therefore, it does not belong over there, it belongs over here in the realm of, let's call it, for lack of something more precise at the moment, a spiritual event. That is to say, an event which is perceived, is apprehended by faith. These events that belong to history, they're not perceived and apprehended by faith. They're perceived and apprehended by all other ways that we have of dealing with and relating to some event. We can see them, we can experience them the way we experience everything else. We can test them, we can go into great lengths to analyze them. And so what he... In the first instance, this sounds like he's claiming, aha, resurrection didn't really take place. It's not historical. But what he really wanted to say was, you cannot disprove the resurrection by historical methods. Now, you know, for an historical event, or for an historical phenomenon to be open to testing and analysis, one of the characteristics that it has to have is that you have to be able to repeat it. And this doesn't look like a repeatable phenomenon. It only happened once. So even in that in its uniqueness there, one might argue that it is placed, therefore, in a different category. Now, under Bultmann's assumptions here, what this would mean, if this doesn't sound too corny now, but to make it absolutely clear what is being proposed here by Bultmann, it would mean that if you had a camera and were on the spot when these resurrection appearances were taking place, that you couldn't photograph Jesus. Because the place that this experience and event is taking place is not objectively or objective, it is subjective. You perceive the resurrected Lord with faith. And Bultmann stresses that the people who saw the resurrected Lord, who perceived him, were also people who had believed in Jesus beforehand and who had had an intimate contact with him. Just the populace at large did not experience the resurrected Lord. Now, question please.
Do you think that's the point of view that the gospel writers are coming at? Because my studying of it, it seemed like Luke was trying to prove that Jesus was very much there when he says that he shows them the nail prints in his hands and then he eats a boiled fish. It's trying, my impression that for Luke at least, if you had your camera there and took the picture, I think he thinks you would see Jesus there.
His interpretation.
That's his, yeah. That's his viewpoint, and I would say, is Bultmann basing his point of view on what the writers were trying to do? Or is he offering another interpretation?
Let me try to answer that this way. You know, I may be wrong, but I think that Bultmann would say that, you know, can you think back to the, do you know the Noah stories in Genesis 6 to 9? It says that after Noah built the ark, he got in there with all the animals, and God came down and shut the door. Now, Bultmann would say, you couldn't have photographed that's a way of talking about God. It's real. It's not factual. When it says that God walked in the garden or that God picked up clay and shaped human beings, that's theological, poetic language that has theological truth to it, but you couldn't have photographed it. It's a way of trying to speak about God who is ultimately not, cannot be couched are contained in human language. So you use picture language, you use poetry, you use this, that, as attempts to try to say something about that which transcends and cannot be contained by human language. So I think that what Bultmann would say is that, to be sure, those guys are talking precisely as though it's an everyday, ordinary occurrence, but that it belongs to a different order of reality, that it transcends a normal everyday thing. Now, yeah, I think that you're right in that Luke and whoever believes that the Lord was precisely there and that he ate the fish and that they felt the wounds, etc. Bultmann's interpretation of that is, as I understand him, that this is not a figment of the imagination. This does not arise out of the psychological longings that the dead Jesus would come back, and so they kind of hallucinated themselves and perceived this. But he rather wants to stress that it cannot, that it is an event that is of a different order than ordinary other events, and that because it is that, because it's something exceedingly special, therefore it is not subject to disproof. And so, to get at your point here, what I'm saying is that Bultmann is coming at this from the point of view of how can you make the resurrection an event which bears real spiritual importance for a world which has been taught to think about reality in pretty much positivistic, historical-critical terms. I mean, the average man on the street, if there be such a thing, who is not particularly caught up in the Christian religion, his worldview does not permit the notion that the dead rise. Why? Because the dead don't rise. And that seems unbelievable, you see. Just as you don't walk on water. And so what Bultmann is trying to say is that let's guard against that objection by modern man, and let's understand this for its spiritual reality, but let's don't understand it as just an event that belongs in the chain of all other events. Now, people have really given Bultmann a hard time on this, and one of the other leading German theologians by the name of Wolfhart Pannenberg, some of you have read some of his stuff maybe in Charlie Wilson's classes, he thinks Bultmann's full of you-know-what. And he sets out a very lovely article in which he tries to demonstrate the resurrection is, I don't know if it can be photographed or not, but that it does belong in the order of all other historical events.
I would wonder, at what point did the resurrection transcend normal reality? Because if it immediately became spiritual reality, then nothing would have happened to the tomb. I mean, the body wouldn't have been gone, I'm assuming if that happened. At what point, you know, how could a spiritual reality eat a fish? I mean, did it just kind of disappear suddenly?
Yeah,
I mean,
well, that's
I have a hard time with that.
Good question.
Do you know what I'm getting at?
Yes, oh, indeed, I do. I'm not sure what Bultmann, how he would, you know, I could guess how he would answer you, but I won't attempt to do that for the sake of our discussion. I'm essentially wanting you to be aware of how one branch of New Testament scholarship sort of approaches this, and to let you view just very briefly how some people operate when they attempt in a genuine way to make the New Testament relevancy. And that's the Bultmann's way of doing it. Here, Jim.
Well, I don't know very much about the philosophies like first or second century or anything like that, but it seems to me I heard something sometime that like the epistles first and second, and even third John, were written to disprove some sort of, was it Gnosticism or something, that was claiming that Jesus had a spiritual reality and not a physical one. That was why John wrote, "He who believes that Jesus came, or that Christ came in the flesh, has eternal life." And so he was emphasizing the word was indeed flesh. And it sounds like really similar to what Bultmann's trying to put forth.
You mean in the attempt to combat an objection?
Yeah,
there's certainly a similarity to that, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, Christian theology has usually been formulated in response to some strange aberration. I mean, after it was all said and done, and we're into the second century in the Christian era, as people were trying to make sense of and apply and talk about and construct a theology, a way of thinking and talking about Jesus, there were philosophical currents which led some segments to say, you know, Jesus looked like a human being, but in fact he really wasn't. He was pure spirit. And that was part of the Gnostic influence, and you have, therefore, well, it's happened before the second century, to be sure. It happened as early as the first. You had people, indeed our gospel writers, some of them, making emphases in the way they tell the story in order to combat one or another aberration that wants to sort of lead you astray. Hence the necessity in classic Christian doctrine of saying, look, Jesus is the Son of God. He's a spiritual person. But he's also human. And you know, the human mind is basically unhappy with those kinds of tensions. And the Jewish milieu was unhappy with that because God can't be a human, see. And so Christianity was affirming a new paradoxical dialectic thing here. And Christian tradition has tried to hold in tension those two things. And you can note in some Christian denominations the direction of one side of those things. And you note in another stream of denominational tradition the greater emphasis on the divinity of Jesus. There's someone back here first, I think, before John. Dawn or someone had a hand? I didn't mean to pass you by. Still have the question? Event, that's right. Jesus' resurrection. I think that he means to say that if you would say, Bultmann, did the resurrection, was there a resurrection? You'd say, yeah. Was it a historical event, he'd say on. Why wasn't it a historical event? Because he would say it belongs to a different order of reality than the fact that we're sitting here around the fire. And that the resurrection was more than just with your eyeballs seeing Jesus come into the room. That you didn't just apprehend him by seeing him or by touching his wounds. That the apprehension of the risen Lord was a much more profound and a greater spiritual event. Well, he doesn't like the word historical event. He doesn't like that. Because a historical event means that it's like every other event. It is analogous to historical events, but it is different. Its reality is of a different... That he was born, Bultmann would say yes. That he was born in some miraculous conception, Bultmann would say no. That's just like all the other stories about heroes, and that was constructed in order to show that Jesus was something special, and that if you in that day and age, if you talked about your heroes in terms of virgin births, then here you've got a super duper hero, you darn well have to talk about him in terms of a virgin birth. That would be Bultmann's way of looking at that. And so Bultmann and others who take that view of the, our usual notion of virgin birth, etc., would say Jesus as the Son of God, Jesus as divine and as Messiah, gets that special quality not from his birth but from his baptism. That's when Jesus became Son of God, not at his birth. Well, that view, of course, offends the majority of Christian thought because you have to take that as historical. Bultmann said it happened. But it's a different kind of a happening. Well, that's a legitimate question. I suppose that the way I would attempt to answer that, like trying to speak for that point of view, would be something that I do consider very legitimate, a distinction that I consider legitimate. And I think that it's very hard to get people to understand it somehow, because we're such literalists on the one hand, and we're accustomed to thinking in a Greek rather than in a Hebraic way. That is, that one makes a distinction, one ought to make a distinction between fact and truth. A distinction between fact and truth. Parable is not factual. Story tells the truth. Does that mean it's less important? We probably wouldn't say that, because we're quite accustomed to thinking of parables as bearers of spiritual truth which Jesus told. And nobody in his right mind is going to argue the parables of Jesus are stories that somewhere happened. Now, one can go from that to the notion that other stories and other things that are told in the scriptures, Old and New Testament, are true. That is to say, they convey spiritual, religious truth about God, about us, about the world, whatever. But that as to whether they happened or not is both questionable and in the long run unimportant. You take an example that's pretty easy to deal with, although there's a great variance of opinion on it, and that's the story of Jonah. In the long run, it seems to me, it's unimportant whether you or whether an individual thinks the story of Jonah really happened. You can say it happened or you can say it didn't happen. You can say it's historical, you can say it's a parable or a fable or whatever category you want to put it under. But whichever way you want to go, it does not really have to do with whether or not that story conveys a very significant and profound theological truth and therefore preaches a message that we can apprehend and be moved by and etc., etc. So if you can make then a distinction between fact and truth, you may be able to see what Bultmann is driving at. The resurrection is real. It conveys truth, ultimate truth. But it does not belong to those order of events which are the everyday and which are apprehended in the usual way. You apprehend that is to say, you perceive it with the gift that you call faith. That's a good point. It does, one could perhaps bring that objection to Bultmann. I think he would have an answer for that, but the way I've explained it, which is certainly very superficial, one could gain that notion. Now, what he doesn't mean to say is that Jesus' spirit came alive, but his body really didn't. Those guys perceived a body, but a spiritual one. A spiritual body. That is to say, a body. Jesus' resurrected body is a transformed body. And that Paul speaks of Jesus that way, and also of our resurrection is that way. That there is a connection between the resurrected body of the believer, but that it's not really the same body. It's transformed, it's different, it belongs to a different order. And I think one of the ways that the biblical material wants to point in that direction is the fact that Jesus passes through locked doors and he appears and he disappears. And he does both. He also walks and he's hungry and he's got to eat and they give him fish and all that. You know, he's not an apparition. He's not a figment of the mind. And one of the great criticisms of Bultmann has been that's what Bultmann really does, that he finds the reality of this whole thing in the arising of faith in the individual. And the criticism of him has been that he just kind of psychologizes this whole thing away. Let's see, I passed by a couple people here, John and then Steve.
My question was kind of brought up in this.
Okay.
I guess one thing I thought is that Christ coming to earth was to relate, well, it's kind of what Jesus was talking about, to relate God to us. It's not like, you know, God closing the door on Noah, and you couldn't have taken a picture of that, but Jesus came to relate God to us, and I would think that the resurrection would be part of that, too, and wouldn't have suddenly changed. I don't know.
Yeah. Greg, please.
If you consider that God is in an eternal sort of time state, that doesn't even really time anymore, and that when Christ came to earth, this is God touching on time, which is a one-line type of thing in the Hebraic tradition. And so God has come in, and as a human being, he's come in to this time, and then he has died. He's left the time frame and sort of gone back to this other time frame, but then I think in order to complete the ministry he still has to be showing himself as more, you know, presenting himself to the human mind, and it doesn't really it isn't the human body, it is the transformed body, because he's no longer in the same time frame, he's died. This is the end of a completely human type of person. And he comes back with the transformed body just to complete the ministry in those last 40 days. And I think maybe this would kind of help explain what Bultmann is getting across.
No, that's I find that helpful. Well, it seems to me, to sum up, it seems to me what is important here is this, that the New Testament documents are unequivocal in asserting that the reality, that the resurrection is real. That it is not something that the disciples cooked up. That it is not simply a kind of spiritual reality. That in the long run, as far as I'm personally concerned, it doesn't matter whether you tag the term history or non-history onto the event, that it is nevertheless the foundation stone for the Christian faith. It is absolutely true, as Paul emphasizes, it seems to me, that without a resurrection, there would be no Christianity. There absolutely would be no Christian movement. Why is that? It seems to me it's very important to understand in constructing a theological understanding of the death and resurrection of our Lord, that when Jesus died, this is much clearer in the synoptics than in John, who takes a different perspective. But when Jesus died, that movement and the hopes that attached to it, both from the side of the apostles as well as others, were absolutely shattered. And that when those guys left Jesus before he was crucified, and some of them no doubt saw him from afar, there's absolutely no doubt that they were frightened to death. That this that what had been spawned in the 1 to 3 years of Jesus' ministry was understood by the disciples to be dealt and a crushing blow. There is nothing short of a genuine encounter with the Lord which would have changed those cowering, fearful men and women into people who were willing to and in fact did risk their lives for what they believed to be the truth. So that Bultmann, yea or nay, one has to assert that they experienced the Lord in a fantastically overpowering and dramatic way which transformed them. Here again, this emphasis that we've noted time and again. However much they were moved to believe in Jesus during his earthly life, their perceptions of him as who he really was did not take place until they met him on Easter morning. And it is at that point that there was a great transformation in their belief. Doesn't mean there was a great transformation in their ethical life or their morals. They're still sinful people, still capable of doubt, no doubt. Still capable of inter-theological squabbles. Perceiving the resurrected Lord did not prevent them from heretical views. After all, Peter and Paul really had it out on a theological point. Peter lost. Paul won. Real bad stuff going on there in the early church. So, all of a sudden, transformation by Jesus doesn't guarantee you from either making mistakes or coming up with bad theology. But what it did do was it began the reconciling work of putting a world that was broken back together again. And that, the kind of work that did then, of course, continues today. It is the call of the Christian church to both participate in the brokenness of the world and also to bring to it the healing power that transforms lives. Our old selves are always present after we've met the resurrected Lord. Of course, we meet the resurrected Lord entirely differently from the way that they did. On the other hand, we meet the resurrected Lord precisely the way they did. How are you encountered by the resurrected Lord, and how do you make a response to that? You do it by faith. And so it seems to me there's a way in which Bultmann is right, in that the disciples who saw him on Easter morning were not spared. They were not spared the necessity of the leap of faith, I believe. You and I are called by the gospel to come into a relationship to God that requires faith on our part. And if you don't mind the Kierkegaardian language, a leap of faith. That language, because there's a sense in which faith is a leap into the unknown. It is trusting in that which you have no final proof for. Absolutely. And so I don't believe that for those early disciples, I don't believe they were spared that requirement. So that there's, an ambiguity, if you haven't tired of that word, there is an ambiguity in their confrontation of the resurrected Lord. They see him, but there's a way in which, above all, they perceive him by faith. And so, one oughtn't to think of the distinction between contemporary faith in Jesus and the disciples' faith on Easter as greatly different. It's not that, gee whiz, they got to see the resurrected Lord, but we don't. And there's a way in which that's said, I think. But you can't emphasize that, overemphasize it, at the expense of the other. There was no doubt in the early community, especially in the Johannine community. Wow, the whole Thomas story, the end of chapter 20, is geared to addressing that problematic. Thomas, who has believed but yet have not seen. Now, what about these resurrection appearances in chapter 21? As your commentaries have pointed out, and as even the superficial reader cannot help but overlook, The original Gospel of John no doubt drew to a close in chapter 20, verse 30 and 31. That's the conclusion to the original Gospel, although we have a chapter that comes after it. Those verses which bring it to a conclusion, I think, are very beautiful. The writer is sort of sitting back now. He's done his job. And he's adding concluding remark. And he wants to let us know that what's written in these 20 chapters is more or less a minimum of things. He says, there were indeed many other signs that Jesus performed in the presence of his disciples, which aren't written in this book. That tells you in the first place that he's made a selection, and that will substantiate for you the claim that is made all along here, namely that gospel writers select, that they choose. There are seven signs, or six, not counting the resurrection, miraculous events, and we're not to assume that that's all that Jesus ever did. Even if we knew only the book of John, we wouldn't assume that on the basis of what he says here. I've told you just a few. These here that I wrote are those here. Those here written have been recorded in order that you may hold the faith that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that through this faith you may possess life in his name. Very simple. If you ask the question, why did John write the gospel, he tells you right there. Very simple reason. He wants to record this so that you can come to faith. And he does it rather beautifully. Now, what a dramatic climax. I've written this so that you can have faith, and so that through faith you can have eternal life. Punct. Period. So it's rather abruptly and somewhat disconcertingly that chapter 21 goes on. No connection really to what goes on there at that in those verses, except the editorial link in the words, sometime later, Jesus showed himself to his disciples once again by the Sea of Tiberias. And then you have in the last chapter the final story, or final incidents, in which Jesus confronts some of his disciples, and which largely has to do with a fishing story. Commentators all give a replete list of why this chapter is different in theology and language and thought form and outlook, etc., etc., from the rest of John. So very early in the tradition, the conclusion is that chapter 21 was tacked on, and that's why if you outline the whole book, or if you look at someone's outline, you will usually find the idea that chapter 21 forms an appendix. What do you perceive as the theological import of chapter 20? You've read it and thought about it. Aside from the fact that we may judge it to be a later edition, though not very much later, what's the significance of it? Can you boil it down to, you know, one central thought? Must be a reason it was included. What does it tell us? What do you think it's about? Or is it about several things? Yeah, indeed. There is that note of anticipated martyrdom, possibly, that following Jesus may involve your very life in a way that means, in an ultimate sense. I mean, you have to commit your whole life to Jesus, but that at least in that day and time you could possibly be a martyr. You could possibly be a martyr too. Fritz mentioned that the other day in his sermon in the Third World.
Well, one thing, Jim? I see, it's sort of a subtle view, but just the real parallel with Peter denying Christ three times, and then here he has to affirm his love three times. And that, to me, that just really hints me that Christ goes on, and God's only all too conscious of our weaknesses. You know, and yet Peter is still the one who chose to sort of represent the church.
Do you catch any particular significance to the way the chapter begins with the business about fishing and Jesus appearing there? Jesus stood on the beach, it says in verse 4.
Don't you find it remarkable that it says the disciples did not know that it was Jesus? What do you make of this seeing but not recognizing motif? Is there any that strike you as either strange or significant? They saw Jesus there, but they didn't know it was him. What's going on? Can you see? Can you reconstruct what possible event in the early church could stand behind that as its fuller meaning? Saw Jesus, but they didn't know who he was. Steve?
They have something to do with this is a story of them being called again now that Jesus has been glorified. And I'm not sure how the not being recognized would fit in.
Do you see any parallel between this appearance and the Easter Day appearances? Ah, good. I hadn't thought of that one. Mary didn't recognize him. Are there some other recognition?
When he appears to the disciples, they kind of are afraid and they're startled and he shows them the
wounds. Yeah? What do they think they're seeing?
Ghosts.
Yeah. Fascinating. Interesting about that, by the way, is that, do you recall, it's not so much in John, but it's in Mark. About every two or three chapters or more, there's the thing where Jesus sort of gets him aside and now, I'm going to tell you what now. You know, the Son of Man is going to have to suffer and die and rise again on the third day. And then they go on and they do stuff, and here's 6 months later, Jesus says pretty near the same thing. You can trace through Mark very definite prophecies of Jesus coming in, death. All the more in the light of that, it is so remarkable that when the thing finally happens, they still don't quite catch it at first. Why is that remarkable? Possibly. Go on.
Okay, Mary didn't catch it, and these guys didn't later on. And the beloved disciple didn't catch it. So isn't it the evangelist's intention that when he's writing his gospel, he's writing to future people who won't have Jesus in sight, and he's saying, now look, all these people see him, yet they don't see him. And the beloved disciple at the tomb, he didn't see me, but he believed. And it's that second sight that...
That's a good answer. That is what I would call a theological answer. You pull there together quite a few things and shape them in such a way that that at least a possible, if not the possible, intention of the evangelist comes across. That was a good answer.
Well, one thing I found kind of like a key phrase was when Jesus told Mary, "Don't cling to me." And I think that they didn't recognize him, and that meant that, you know, all they had to remind them of Jesus was his words and his deeds. That's what they remembered him for. When he broke the bread, you know, in that other gospel, that's when they recognized him. And also from things he said. And it's sort of like saying, you know, don't cling to me, you know.
By the way, there's the story in Luke. It's always been, to me, one of the most moving stories in the Gospels. That's this story in the last part of Luke about the two disciples on their way to Emmaus. It's after the resurrection has taken place. It's on Easter Day. These guys are walking along from Jerusalem to Emmaus, and all of a sudden Jesus sort of sidles in with them, and he talks to them, and he said, "Well, what are you guys talking about?" And I said, "You know, are you the only guy around here who hasn't heard the momentous events? Haven't you heard that Jesus of Nazareth, who we thought was going to be a great prophet, he was crucified, etc.?" They don't see that this guy is Jesus. And they walk along, and he begins to sort of open up the scriptures to them, but he doesn't tell them yet who he is. And then they get to their place, and he says, "Well, I'm going to continue on." They say, "Ah, Lord, this evening, abide with us, the night is far spent." So he goes in, and what, of course, do they do? They get out the bread and the wine, and what happens? in the breaking of the bread, they perceive that it's Jesus. Now, there's no doubt that in that story, there is a reflection of the early Eucharistic practice of the church, as well as the practice of today, that where is it that we perceive Jesus? In the breaking of the bread and the wine. But there, anyway, their eyes are closed until a particular moment. So this theme of it, not at first perceiving who Jesus was, but then perceiving, is common to the whole tradition. And it may point to the fact that no doubt about that in my mind either. Now, the commentators, as far as chapter 21, will draw to our attention the fact that there's something odd here in the setting. Where did the resurrection take place? Well, Jerusalem, it looks like. Where are these guys? They're Galilee. What are they doing? They're fishing. It's slightly odd that all those years they were with Jesus and they ceased to be professional fishermen. And indeed, the disciples hardly are described as fishermen in the Gospel of John. You notice that? They're very specifically pointed out as fishermen, some of them at least, in the other Gospels. But John's never dwelt on that. All of a sudden here, these guys are not only back at Galilee, which is a good way off, but they're out there fishing. The story comes from a tradition that probably did not originate in the Johannine. It is meant in its theological intention to be one in a series of resurrection appearances in which the Lord, showing himself, seeks to confirm and strengthen the apostles and in a way to commission them. Stuck with Peter, tend my sheep is a kind of commissioning. After the Lord has been raised, then there is work to do, and many of the stories point in that direction. The recognition comes in a little later in this particular story. And again, who was pointing out, disciple whom Jesus loved, who looks in and sees the empty tomb and believes. And here again it says, the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. Peter hadn't quite caught that yet. But old Peter, since he figures that out, he jumps into the sea to swim out. That's why he's often been thought of as the one who's rather impetuous. Lord, I'll never deny you. And another jumps in and sinks. He's like those of us who act very much on impulse. I'm sort of a big old dog, shaggy dog. Is always jumping up on you and kind of slobbering on you, who hasn't a lot of discipline and self-control, but is full of love. But it's not channeled very well into disciplined ways. Peter seemed to be that sort of a personality. Well, it's significant in this chapter, finally, that this whole thing, it doesn't culminate in it, but it has one of its high points in a meal. In a meal. Bring in your catch. They brought it in. 153. Sort of miraculous event here. More fish than you could normally catch in the nets. Come and have breakfast, Jesus says. And it says, none of the disciples dared to ask, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus now came up, took bread and gave it to them, and the fish in the same way. Perhaps an allusion to a Eucharistic meal. Perhaps not. No wine is mentioned. But in the early church, please recall, the gathering together around a meal was a very significant event. It was part, usually, of their worship, in a way. The sharing in common of food in the Orient is one of the most intimate ways you can deal with people. I mean, we are so casual in our current lifestyle that we don't stop to quite understand what it went on in the Orient as far as a meal was concerned. We'll say to our neighbor, hey, why don't you come over tomorrow night? You know, we're going to cook some hamburgers, a few beers, and have a very informal meal. People come in, sit down, drop in, have a little pizza. It's fun, but it's no big deal. We do it all the time. But table fellowship in the Orient and in the ancient primitive church, to share a meal with someone was a symbol that you were also sharing your total self. And so it's not it's not insignificant that the early church's recognition of the presence of the Lord in their midst took place at that very moment where people were sharing in the most intimate way that it was possible in their culture, namely when you eat, when you have something to eat. So bread and wine was simply present at every meal because that's what they had to eat, among other things. We're not some kind of special elements. It was the everyday. The elements themselves were not special. We have invested bread and wine with the kind of significance that they didn't really have then, or bread and wine has taken on a symbolic significance that far transcends their original usage, although, of course, in the Jewish Passover meal, bread and wine had religious significance too, but it was in that intimate sharing of a meal. And those of you who've been to the Mideast, or those of you who will go perhaps, or have some experience with Near Eastern and therefore Oriental culture, I don't mean Oriental in the sense of the Far East, though it may obtain there too, you may have the chance to experience what so-called Oriental or Near Eastern hospitality is like. And if people invite you to their table, well, that's no casual thing. That is an invitation to, for them, one of the most significant and humane ways of conveying a sharing that you can possibly think of. Well, one might note, finally, two things. That in verse 25 of this chapter, look what it says. There's much else that Jesus did. If it were all to be recorded in detail, I suppose the whole world could not hold the books that would be written. Remarkable parallel between verse 25 there and verse 30 and 31 in the previous chapter. It's again a kind of final statement. A whole lot more could be written. Indeed it were, the world couldn't hold all the books. So you have a final, once again, a final kind of conclusion, which is almost anticlimactic in the view of the ending of chapter 20. Well, this is the eschatos. That is to say, this is the end.